Welcome to the Family Express podcast, where our destination is resilient and connected families. Come aboard with your hosts, marriage and family therapists, Catherine DeBruin and Rhonda Evans, to explore the world of emotionally focused family therapy, a model developed by Sue Johnson and colleagues. Together with our guest speakers, our travels will map the EFFT landscape, highlighting lessons learned, shared fears, and the passion and curiosity that bonds our community.
Welcome back to the next episode of the Family Express with Catherine and Rhonda. We have a great conversation in store for our listeners, for you all for today. Our guest speaker today joining us is Dr. Ta Ying, located in Toronto, Canada. And we're just so appreciative to have Dr. Ta Ying here. And we're going to be talking about parental blocks with Chinese families. Dr. Ta Ying, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, great to be here. This is such a great topic.
Oh, and I know you have a lot of experience with this. And actually, let's just start with that. Could you give us a little background on your experience working with families?
Yeah, so I started working with families as a family physician. This is almost four decades ago. And then I realized, you know, pills don't fix everything, right? And then I went back to grad school to learn about family therapy, became also a family therapist and supervisor. And then that expanded my range of interventions. But then I started learning EFT and I fell in love with it. So working with families using attachment frame, system frame, experiential frame, emotions, it's so powerful. And since then, I never looked back. I became certified in EFT, became a supervisor and an international trainer, mostly working in Asia, specifically in Hong Kong.
Thank you so much, TY, for being on the show with us. And you, I believe you live in Toronto, but then you're doing a lot of the work in Hong Kong and Asia as well.
Yes.
So the families that you work with, what kinds of families and where do you tend to do the work?
Yeah, in terms of our practice, I'm in a group practice with seven physicians and also seven psychotherapists and social workers. So we're in a very multi-ethnic area of Toronto. But having said that, most of my families are still Chinese families. So mostly are Cantonese speaking, some are Mandarin speaking, but it's a pretty much a multi-ethnic community in which our practice is located. Now, when I do consultations with therapists, professional helpers in Hong Kong, then obviously those are Chinese families, Cantonese speaking families. Yeah. And because we are kind of like a tertiary referral center, we never get those simple families. We never get those easy families, right? You always get the complex trauma, special need, mental illness, the very complex families. Which is great because it's challenging for me to work with and I learn new things every day. I never get bored.
Yeah. You have so many degrees and so much education and training and you really have a heart to help families. And that's what took you from, I think, being a physician and then getting trained as a family therapist as well, because you really want to meet not only the physical, but the emotional needs of families. Could you give us an example of a type of family that might call in and like even how they might present for treatment?
Yeah, usually with Chinese families, they don't call in until they are in a deep, big crisis, right? So it gets very, very complicated. So there are emergency situations. My kid hasn't been to school for 6 months. My kid's depressed, suicidal. They're cutting themselves. They're split all over the floor. Okay, overdose, addictions. Kids are withdrawn. This, you know, my son's been in the room for 6 months, hasn't come out. So these are typical situations that come to us.
That's so helpful to know. Thank you, TY. Gosh, those really are families in very complex situations with a lot of distress. And so
right.
Tell us a little bit about how you might approach treatment.
Yeah. So basically with EFT, FFT, the approach is very clear. I already have a clear map. no matter what the presenting symptoms are, I have my attachment. The problem is disconnection. The problem is insecure attachment. And then even with a whole pie of DSM-5 diagnoses, we can make sense of it from attachment frame, right? So we think of Bowlby stages of loss of attachment. And then, you know, you see kids, families go through the angry protests and things are pretty wild when they're in that mode. It's scary, right? And then the anxious clinging phase, all the anxiety disorder, the school refusal, and then the depression of despair, the suicidal, and then, of course, the disengagement, the detachment. So here is a lot of, you know, neurodiverse families maybe fall into that. Addictions also fall into that category. So I think the attachment map, no matter what they present with, how distressing the crisis is, we know what's going on. We not only know what's going on, we know how to fix it step by step. Mm. And then, of course, the system perspective really makes sense in Chinese culture when we look at the extended family, not just individuals.
T.Y., as you're talking about those attachment sort of on that continuum, are you referring to like Robert Robertson's idea of how attachment, the attachment bond can die over time, like the protest and then depression and then detachment? Is that what you're referencing?
Yeah, it's more Bowlby's work in terms of stages of loss of attachment.
Yeah.
And then I'm trying to put it within the DSM-5 framework.
That's fascinating. I've never heard something like this.
So the angry protests, I mean, people can look manic, they can look psychotic, they're paranoid, they're really out of control, right? They're totally dysregulated. So all those would fit into the angry protest stage.
Yeah.
And then the anxious one, all the anxiety disorders, your, you know, separation anxiety, social anxiety, GAD, and then PTSD, probably OCD, all put into that category.
Okay.
And then the depression of despair. So all your depression, unipolar, maybe even some bipolar, manic, maybe it's the more the angry protest, and then the detachment. So that's addictions, some of the ASD, ADHD, in which they are in another world, right?
That's fascinating. Just that is a really fascinating way to pull the dying of the attachment bond and then correlating it with DSM type of disorders, right?
Right.
Wow, I love that. Thank you.
Yeah. So because people usually just get a label, right?
Yeah.
After they see a psychiatrist.
Yeah.
So with this frame, we can help them make sense of the label. No, this is normal, having experienced this and this and the loss of attachment. We all go through this. If you're human, right? You can go through these stages. This all makes sense. So we depathologize. We delabel them. We normalize everything.
Yes, yes.
And that alone is so calming and validating. It really settles the amygdala. So I remember I consulting with a family just on Friday. This family's in Hong Kong, mother and daughter. Daughter was cutting, self-harm, depressed, refused to go to school. So very distressing symptoms. And then I found out a little bit about their history. So the daughter grew up, people didn't accept her, they blame her, but she had special health issues. She had Crohn's, which is very rare in Chinese, right? And no one knew about it. Just blame her. Oh, you made up this pain so you don't have to go to school, right? So you have diarrhea so you don't have to do this project. And she felt blamed all her life. So when I sat down with her, I said, you know, not going to school, being afraid of people, experience this world is unsafe. It's so normal, given what you've been through. I would be the same if I went through the same experience you had, right? And then I asked, has anyone told you that? You're normal. No. No. My parents think I'm crazy. My teachers think I'm a bad student. My relatives think I'm lazy and dumb and stupid. no one's ever told her normal, right? So attachment helps her to look at things with that kind of frame and see people as human beings, not pathology.
Yeah.
And then that alone calms her down. And I already had a great therapeutic alliance with her. All yeah. her previous therapists did not have any alliance, and they could not work with her without yeah. the alliance.
Yeah.
So she started with therapist 3 sessions, and she's done. And other therapists 3 sessions, she's done.
Yeah, right? Really? Wow. That's amazing. Thank you so much for this example. And it's so powerful, the frame that you bring. And then just the way you're speaking, like with your heart comes through. And then, of yeah. course, she can feel that and she starts feeling understood yeah. and calmed.
And unfortunately, this is against the whole system that she's in, right? So she told me a very sad story. I'm seeing a psychologist. And the psychologist told me, don't ever come back unless you come alone without your mother. Because you've been clinging to your mother. Act like a 20-year-old, right? That's so sad to hear. Whereas mm-hmm. I validated her. Of course you need your mother. Mm-hmm. This world is dangerous. People out there to hurt you. They blame you. They attack you. They label you. Of course you need your bodyguard when you go out to feel safe. Of course, it makes so much sense, right? And I said, you come with your mother as long as you need to, right? As long as you need a bodyguard to feel safe until you feel safe on your own. That's totally understandable, right? So people are traumatized. A lot of times the system is not trauma-informed. It's not trauma-sensitive. And I can see her getting re-traumatized in the different treatments, the different systems that she's going through, right?
Definitely on so many different levels, right? Societal, in the system, even in a family system, and then introjected into herself.
Yeah, so I joke with her, you know, you should invite your psychologist to our EFT training.
Yeah, change the system.
It will make a big difference for you.
right. And then what about the parents? Like, give us an example of how you might work in the family system there.
Yeah. So parents are very challenging in Chinese families, right? So especially engaging them. All of them come, Dr. Wong, fix my kid. Here's my kid. Do whatever you need to do. We'll pay you whatever you want. Get them fixed and then give them back to me. So I tell them, yeah, I don't know how to do that. Sorry. I really don't know how to do that, right?
I love that answer. I'm just going to jump in here. I love that answer of, I don't know how to do that.
But what I do know how to do is to help you to build a relationship with your child in which they feel secure, they feel seen, they feel soothed, they feel safe. And then we find the research tells us once that relationship is in place, a lot of the symptoms, the pathology just goes away, right? That's what I can help you with. Are you game for that?
And are they? Are they game? Do you get buy-in?
Usually, because they're desperate. Because they're desperate. We are the last stop, the last resort. They've tried everything else, right? Mm. Yeah. Yeah. So usually, getting the buy-in, engaging the parents is quite challenging. So we use all the strategies in the textbook. We validate the parents, how hard they are working, how much they care for the kid, the sacrifice that they make, and yet nothing is working. That must be so painful, mm-hmm. right? And then we reframe whatever they're doing is pushing the kids away, causing more distress. We reframe it as your attempt to protect them.
Mm-hmm.
Right, because you just see danger, and then you're out to protect them. Unfortunately, that ruins the relationship. It causes insecurity. Yeah. And usually when we do that, and then the blocks start to emerge. Okay. So when we see blocks, there are individual blocks, parts of the parent, their past experience that create blocks that prevent them from attuning with their kid. From being ARE, accessible, responsive, emotionally engaged with their kids. And then a lot of times there are blocks in the couple system. in which the parental co-alliance has been disrupted, or even there's a rupture there. So they don't see eye to eye. It's impossible to work together as a team. And obviously, that affects their effectiveness in bonding with their child. And then lastly, even within extended family, there are blocks that can be barriers. So specifically, the family that I mentioned, I did the consultation for. So in terms of mom, the blocks are worry, 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 worry. And when she's worried, she says things, she does things that are very protective of the daughter. But she's 20-year-old, right? She needs to individuate. She doesn't need to come back under mom's protection, right? Mm. So it really is working against her. So, and then we put that in the context of the daughter's symptoms, right? So she doesn't have any choice in this. She can't make her own decision. Only choice she has is when she cut herself, right? When she refused to eat or refused to school. That's the only area in which she can be normal and individuate as an adolescent. Because all these other areas are blocked, right? So then we make sense of the symptom and validate.
So you're actually, normal. Yeah, so sorry to interrupt. You're actually seeing those behaviors by the child as being individuating attempts.
Yes, yes. Because other avenues individuate have been blocked, right?
Got it.
Yeah, yeah. So, and then, of course, we make sense of the symptoms. So helping mom, you know, deal with her anxiety, supporting it as a therapist, making sense with it. So that's when Move to a Tango, it's so great, right? It helps mom take her anxiety, all her worries, which is so alien, so frightening, so unacceptable, making into normal, making it into, this is so human, right? This is understandable, acceptable. Mm-hmm. And then she calms down, right? So the worry is a common one. Other common we see are sense of helplessness, powerlessness, inadequacy in the parents, okay? And then they can freeze, they can withdraw, they can numb out. And then that's also a block in terms of they can't take action to be responsive and caring when they really need to, because they are frozen at that point. And then the big one for Chinese is shame. Yeah. So shame causes them to withdraw, to hide, right? And again, they freeze when they need to do something to give the kid reassurance. So those are some of the common blocks we see from an individual level. Now, I find because now EFT, there's EFIT, EFCT, FFT, looking at this from an EFIT frame is so powerful. So I name all the parts in the parent, right? So there's a longing to be there for your kid, to be the best parent you can. And then there are these blocks. There's the insecurity, the worry, the shame. So we can name each of the parts and then normalize, validate each of the parts and then integrate the parts together. Very much like EFIT, but we're doing it in the context of a family. Yeah. And then setting up the encounters with other family members. We bring these different parts alive, right? I want so much to be there for you, right? And then my worries pull me away, right? When I get into my worry mode, I overthink, and then that pulls me away from you, right? And you just hear my worries and worries and worries, and then you feel I don't care, right?
This is so powerful, T.Y. Thank you. Thank you. Rhonda, I was just thinking about the question you were asking this morning.
Mm-hmm.
Want to check with T.Y. about whether that could be a typical scenario and how to find the parental intent?
Yeah, let's see if I can articulate it. So T.Y., here's a situation. So it's think of adult children and their parents, and we're doing family therapy, and the adult child is is recalling that in their eyes, they were emotionally caretaking their parents when in their childhood. And the parents are not really seeing it that same way. They have a different perspective. And I've been struggling with, like, how to work with that. And I don't know if I'm getting kind of confused because they're adult children looking back on their childhood and what their experience was. But the questions I had were like, what is the parental intent and how to validate the parental intent? Because it already gets messy in me trying to articulate it.
Yeah. And we see that in an exaggerated form.
Okay.
Very exaggerated. The reason is most of the family I work with are immigrant families. Okay. And you really see the role reversal in immigrant families, right? So kids come here within a year, they're fluent in English, they have friends, they are adapted to the culture. Parents are not.
Okay.
They have really trouble integrating, assimilating the new culture, learning the language. And even they do speak it, it's very awkward. It's never fluent, right? And then that's when the kids become the caregiver. They have to interpret for the parents. Any form, any letter of government, they've opened it and they've explained it. They have to take the parents to the doctor, explain what's going on, right? So a lot of practical caregiving in addition to emotional caregiving.
Okay. Right?
So I see a very exaggerated form of that in families with immigration experience. Now, to compound it, I mentioned most of families I see have trauma, right? And then that makes it even a lot worse. Mm. Yeah. So think working through that with the EFT tangle, right? So when the kids see the parents as being helpless, incompetent, not able to fend for themselves, not able to protect their kids, okay? And then the kids get pulled in.
Oh, that is just like light bulb was going off in my head.
Right.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we use a tangle to work through that, right? So you can say kids are parentified, mm-hmm. okay? But you look at the context, okay? And the context is this. The context is the whole family are fighting to survive. In a new culture, in a new world, in a new language, daddy, mommy are trying to find jobs, make ends meet. The whole family is fighting to survive. So that's the context that I really heighten. So it's not the kids are parentified. We are desperate fighting to survive as a family in a new country. Without roots, without any support, without any financial means, we're all fighting to survive. And then somehow that frame pulls people together.
I just feel pulled together as you say that to me right now.
But we're fighting in different ways, right?
Yes.
But we're all fighting to survive, right?
Yes. And then when we, each of us fights in a different way as we fight to survive.
Yeah, you get disconnected.
You get disconnected.
Yeah.
This is so brilliant. Okay. Thank you so much.
What are you seeing, Rhonda? Because earlier you were really struggling to find what's the parental intent? How do I find it amidst the dynamic? So how is this helping you? What are you recognizing?
Well, as I listen to Dr. Ta-Ying, I'm realizing, I think, that the parents are fighting to survive. And in this case, it wasn't cultural or an immigration context, it was something different. But I can see how the parents were, quote, you know, doing the best they could. And they actually had a rupture in a co-alliance for the parenting. They had two different strategies. So there was that rupture that the couple was trying to navigate without any kind of formal or informal support. And then I can see how they were doing what they could in their own way as parents to fight to survive, but this rupture in the co-alliance was one block. And then the kids experience the family, the parents as helpless. And I forget what other words you use, Dr. Taiying, helpless and not able to.
Inadequate.
Provide. And yeah.
Powerless.
Powerless.
Incompetent.
Yeah. Incompetent.
Unreliable.
Yes. So I'm just realizing that the parents were fighting for survival for the family, again, a different context. And so now I can see the parental intent, Catherine. Now I can see how there was actually this, you naming, Dr. Taiying, this rupture in the co-alliance, which I didn't have that phrase, but I knew that that's what the parents were describing and I was reflecting.
Yeah, and usually they fight at different levels, right? So the parents fight at levels that are practical. I have to put three meals on the table. I have to get the rent paid, right? I have to make sure you are in school. So that's the level the parents are fighting at, right? Mm-hmm. Which leaves little bandwidth for all the other stuff, the emotional stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right? Yes.
Because they are so caught up with the three meals on the table, shelter above head, schooling, right? Mm-hmm. So that takes up all their resources.
Right.
And then there are huge gaps in terms of the emotional level. And then that's where the kids go, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, TY, can I ask you a question as well?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, help me with family systems where you've got a like 16 to 23-year-old child whose behavior seems completely out of control. And when you meet with that kid and the family, it's very evident that there's been like a massive injury somewhere along the line. And so you can see on the family level where the attachment, you know, ruptures need to get healed. But in the meantime, this child is in so much distress that their behavior seems completely out of control. So maybe they're like raging at the parents, they're breaking down doors. It's almost like the behavior in the household is to a level of it being abusive, unsafe, police are getting called, that level.
Mm.
When you hear, when you listen to the child who's protesting, they feel rejected and they feel so alone and disconnected. But when you listen to the parents are considering a higher level of treatment, something like residential care, because they can't manage this kind of behavior in the household. And I get stuck because I feel like the household has got to stabilize for safety and security. But it feels like sending the child away to residential is going to solidify the sense of rejection they feel already.
What
do you do with that? How do you handle
in those dilemmas a lot of times too? So when we need to think about attachment or safety, I think safety is always a priority. So in these situations, we have to do whatever we need to do to keep the kiddo safe, to keep the whole family safe. And it may mean separating. It may mean, you know, residential treatment just to keep everyone safe. So a lot of times we not only get the kid who feels hurt, who's sensitive, who's rejected, you have parents who are also there triggering him. So you're trying to catch a bullet and they're shooting more bullets.
Yes.
And then I say, no, this is not a work. This needs to stop.
Right? Yeah.
So when both sides are escalated and I feel the situation is not safe, I cannot do EFT. Okay? In order to do EFT, you must have safety.
Okay.
And not just the physical safety, it's also the emotional safety.
Yeah.
Because we can only catch so many bullets.
Yeah.
If there's so many people shooting, eventually bullets get through, right? And the kiddo gets hurt, right? So I would, in those families, I would prioritize safety. So what do they need to do to feel safe?
Right? Okay.
Physical safety and emotional safety. And that's maybe, you know, if in younger kids, then you have child protection agencies being involved, right? The older kids, then it's residential treatment or somehow making it safe for the parents and for the kiddo.
Thank you. That's helpful.
Individual treatment does not have to sacrifice attachment bonds, okay? Because the frame I use to treat trauma is E-fit, right? So we're not sacrificing attachment bonds. We're still working at the attachment bonds. And the same way in EFT. So when this kiddo's in treatment, we're doing E-fit. So what are the blocks to having secure attachment? And you're right. It's the same three we mentioned in the textbook. It's a alliance rupture with the parents, right? Common block.
Yeah.
It's empathic failure. When the kids need empathy validation, they don't get any, right? They get anger, they get frustration. And then the third one is attachment injury. So these kids have piles of attachment injuries.
Yeah.
And initially, it probably makes more sense to stabilize them using EFIT.
Yeah.
So that at least they have one secure attachment figure, you, the therapist, right? And then that will hopefully give enough of a secure base and safe haven to do the family work later on.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you know, I'm a physician. I also think of medications, whatever is needed to stabilize them.
Yes, for sure. Thank you. Safety first.
Yeah. So I love EFT, right? Because there's situations you just shift into EFIT and it's so natural. And you shift back to EFFT and it's so natural. It's the same skill, same technique, same tangle, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's seamless when we make these shifts. Or you work with a couple, right? It's great. Or you put them in a group. It's the same stuff.
You are amazing. You're a wealth of information. I'm just sitting here thinking, I need more time with TY. I need to come and work with you and see what you're doing and learn from you. It's so powerful. Thank you. Do you have more examples from your practice, or can I ask you another question?
Yeah, go ahead.
You can. Okay. What do you do in the case where these empathic failures, alliance failures, injuries have gotten so bad that a child has, again, he has a 17-year-old who just ran away from home, like they just want nothing to do with that household and they're gone.
Yeah.
What do you, if you're talking to the parents, like the parents seek you out, what, like, how am I suppose, yeah, what are you going to do with that? Should the parents run after the kid? Should they let the kid that they know that they're available? Like, what does one do in that case?
Yeah. So even if the kid runs off, doesn't come to session and just the parents come, I would still work with the parents. Because in stage one, you really don't need the kid there, right? You're working on a parent, you're softening them, you're getting the buy-in, right? You're heightening the parental intent and you're identifying and working through the parental blocks. I mean, it's nice for the kid to be there, but the kid doesn't have to be there. So I would still work with the parents. Okay. And two things can happen, right? The parents can shift, become more ARE, and sometimes that's enough to bring the kid back. And sometimes that's not enough to bring the kid back. It's gone too far, right? And then just like EFIT, then we have to help the parents grieve the loss and accept the situation and then set the boundaries. And then I won't have a close relationship with my kid. What kind of relation do I have? And if they have to really, really work that out.
Yeah.
So it's the same as the EFIT situation. You have an imagined encounter with a significant attachment figure. And it's nice if they can respond, they can turn around, they can show regret for what they've done. And then repair is possible.
Yeah.
But if they don't, then it's grief. It's setting the appropriate boundaries and then moving on so that both parties can move on. Now, it's always sad, but it happens. And, you know, we need to do what we need to do, right? So I call these situations, a lot of time we try to fix the unfixable, right?
Yeah.
It only makes things worse. It only makes things worse. So I would try EFT, see how much traction we get. And if it doesn't work, then you do have to shift gears.
It sounds like you work with a lot of mental illness as well as addiction. Like in the case where parents are coming in and that child's already gone over to some kind of addicted behavior and is out in the world in a dangerous, situation. What do you advise for those parents in terms of the boundaries, or like, do they still resource that person out there in some way? What can you do, right?
Yeah. So I always say you hope for the best. At the same time, you plan for the worst. Hope for the best and plan for the worst. So the best is they come back, you're able to rebuild your relationship, have secure attachment, which will help with addictive behavior. The worst is they don't come back. The addiction gets worse. They're too caught up in it, right? And then the addiction becomes a pseudo-attachment, right? And then they're never able to get out of that cycle. And then the parents have to grieve, set healthy boundaries, and then move on, right? Yeah. So it's always a sad situation to see. But in EFT, I think this is something we need to talk about more, right? We say, oh, EFT is so successful, right? And couples, 3 out of 4 get cure, 93% have big improvement. How about the rest?
Right. And the ones who don't make it in, right?
We do need to address that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you. It's heavy, right? But it's
So in my mental illness support group, I remember last session, we spent the whole session talking about grief, right? It's one of the things when we're dealing with mental illness is people try to fix the unfixable, whereas they need to step back and start grieving, right? Mm-hmm. So the lost dream, the lost expectation, your child will never become the child that you wished them to be, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or they might not even be able to support themselves, right? That's hard. And then parents go through the denial, they go through the anger, they go through the bargaining, gradual depression, gradual acceptance, and then the 6th stage is they make meaning of it, right? So I think helping parents to do that as a couple using EFCT or as individual using EFIT would be very helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of fixing the unfixable.
Right, right. Mm. Thank you. Thank you, TY.
Yeah. And it's a shocker when I tell people that, right? You're trying to fix the unfixable. They think they can fix everything. No, you can't.
Right. Yeah. And then there's loss and grief, which Bowlby talked about. So
This is where Sue Johnson, she's doing EFIT, right? So I guess a decade ago, Catherine, if we ask her, Sue, what's the core emotion we get to an EFT, she says fear, right?
Yeah.
But when she started doing EFIT, getting more, now she says it's loss.
Really?
It's sadness. It's grief.
Wow.
That's the core. It's not fear. It's sadness. It's loss, right? Especially in the past, probably 5, 6 years when she's been doing exclusively EFIT, she shifted in terms of the core emotion. Before, it's fear, right?
Yeah.
Fear of abandonment, fear of rejection, fear of betrayal, all those. Now it's loss.
Of
connection.
And I mean, Bowlby's trilogy, wasn't one called something about anxiety and one was loss?
Loss, yep. So, it seems that loss is the big one, right?
So tell me more about that. Like, what does that mean? What changed in Sue, or how is loss more significant than fear, do you think?
Yeah, I think loss has to do more with acceptance, with compassion, right?
Mm-hmm.
With being able to move on despite everything.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that makes sense, right? And the families we see, especially complex trauma families, there's tons of loss.
Yeah.
Most of it is unfixable.
Okay.
Most of it is unfixable.
But right? Coming to a place, if you work through the loss and you come to a place of acceptance and compassion, you're saying that's very powerful.
Yes.
Okay. There's a lot of change that can happen if you work through grief and then you get back to the core attachment needs in life, which are
Right.
Just love, yeah. Right? And acceptance.
Because you see families stuck in the pattern, trying to fix things, right?
Yeah.
So the kid has a problem since they're 3, they're same problem 13, and they're 33.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now they're 53, and they're still trying to fix.
Yeah.
Fix.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen. You need to grieve, right?
And come and sometimes to the stillness and calm.
And use a very powerful image to heighten how grieving the loss is so important. Right? So imagine your loved one died.
Yeah.
Imagine you didn't have a funeral.
Yeah.
People did not come to comfort you, to acknowledge your loss, to help you to have closure and move on. Imagine the body is just sitting there,
mm-hmm.
day after day, night after night, rotting. 1 year, the corpse is still there.
Mm-hmm.
10 years, the corpse is still there.
Mm.
30 years, of course, is still there. It starts to get stinky, right? And then you're still holding on to the corpse.
Mm.
That's what you're doing if you're not mourning and you're not moving on, right? You're holding on to the corpse. Now, because these losses are not, you know, physical loss, people don't die.
Yeah.
What's died is the dream, expectations, ideals. Yeah. We don't have those rituals to help people to mourn and to have some closure and to move on, right?
Yeah.
So even sometimes the system makes people stuck. They're still trying to hold on. They're still trying to fix the unfixable.
Yeah.
And they're saying, enough is enough. You need to move on, right?
T.Y., thank you so much for that beautiful image and speaking to us about your work on attachment bonds and how those can start feeling distressed and then how they undergo changes and can eventually die. And we've talked about families and how children symptomize and then how sometimes they even leave the home and there's just so much grief and loss that we have to help families do. And even as we're talking here about grief and loss and letting things go, I feel like I've made an amazing discovery in just how wonderful you are and how much I really want to sit at your feet and learn from you. Thank you so, so much for sharing your work and your heart and your passion and your wisdom today with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I really enjoy this discussion.
Tell us where we can find you. Like, where can we come and learn more from you? What do you have going on?
Well, unfortunately, you have to know Chinese. This, well, my Chinese.
Hi, there's that Chinese. little problem, yeah, for me.
Yeah.
Oh.
Well, that. Well, but,
you know, sometimes we do have some training resources in English. Like I have one of the first EFFT training series that's endorsed by Sue. This was out like almost 10 years ago. Working with a kid with this male with eating disorder, right? Who's depressed, mm-hmm. anxious. So working, I think we did 12 sessions. So I made a little training series for that. So we do have some families that I work with in English, but
where do we find that video?
Eah,
there's want to buy that.
We have reconnecteft.com is where we put all our trainings. So you have to shift through it and then look at which ones are in English.
Okay.
Wow, that would be such a gem.
Yeah.
I just want to echo what Catherine said. I know it's my first time meeting you, Dr. Tat Ying, and I just have the same feeling that Catherine does. I just want to go on like a 5-day retreat with you and just like get a download and experience with you. All of what you said has really impacted me. It's hard to even put into words. It's very organizing. It's so attachment focused. You just ooze attachment, and I can't get enough of it. I can't get enough of attachment whatsoever. So I'm just so excited to get to meet you and know that you're out there and tell people about you and make sure people know that the amazing wealth of knowledge and love and passion that you have. So thank you so much.
Yeah, keep up your great work. Yeah, the Family Express podcast is great work, right?
Thank you, thank you.
EFFT doesn't get much attention.
Right? Yes, we're trying to change that.
I think it's the future.
It's coming.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I'm happy that our Chinese listeners and therapists have the amazing resource in you. Yeah. I'm definitely going to. I do think I've got a copy of that that family video. I need to watch that again. Yeah. I feel like you gave that to us way back. So thank you.
Yeah,
so much.
Yeah. This was been about a decade ago.
Yes, I think so.
We
yeah.
We were in Ottawa. Yeah. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. All right.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Have a great day. Thank
Welcome.
You.
Yep. You too. Okay. Bye-bye. Take bye. Care.
That's it for today, folks. Thank you for listening, and we hope to see you again for our next journey.